This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 250, Summer. Of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So 250, that's like a quarter of a thousand.
When you say it like that, it sounds like not much.
I know, right? That's a quarter of 10.
That's like saying, I'm a hundredaire.
Girl, I achieved that when I was like 20 something. Yeah, I know. So do we have any announcements this week? Oh, we kind of had an announcement we put out there last night. What was that?
I mean, I've heard rumors.
Yeah, there have been rumors. I mean, the rumors are started by us. Yeah, so we are absolutely thrilled to be back sharing the stage with our Outlander friends and fans, Sarah Kaizak from Outlander TV News and Mandy Tidwell from Great Scott Blog. We will be at San Diego Comic-Con 2018 on the dais and, you know, have our a fan discussion panel about Outlander. So we're very excited. This episode is part of our Drums of Autumn read-along. To find out more and how to participate, visit outlanderpod.com/DOA.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we will be discussing Chapter 36, entitled, You Can't Go Home Again.
We are in Inverness, and it is 1769. Lorraine B. starts us off. Summer. Lorraine B. starts us off. The title of this chapter says you can't go home again, meaning things will never be the same. We find Roger at once in awe of witnessing the history of his hometown and yet feeling like he is coming home again after he comes through the stones and makes his way to Inverness. Can we get a hee-haw or a yoo-hoo or a woo-hoo? Roger has made it to Inverness. It's a big step, people. And if you haven't read the book before, woo, doggies, we are now hot to trot. Roger is in Inverness, looking to book passage to the colonies. He notices the differences the 200 years has made, but still recognizes it. He remembers Huntley Street. The Reverend's own church wasn't even there. It wasn't built until 1837. And the manse wouldn't be built until the early 1900s. He even notices that the air is the same, but there's no smell of car exhaust, though it has been exchanged for the smell of sewage. Over the River Ness, there is only one stone footbridge, but the River Ness was mostly the same. Roger also mentions, quote, great copper beeches that would one day surround the house, not yet planted. Unquote. Summer, do you remember hearing about copper beaches during Pot Abroad?
Like copper pants? Did you say beaches or breeches?
Beaches, like the trees.
Oh. Maybe they're the ones that the leaves turn kind of coppery. That's my guess.
Yeah, so the first time, maybe not in my life, but when I was reading this chapter, and the first thing that came to mind when I read copper beaches was when we were at Drummond Castle Gardens, she was talking about how there was one side of the, maybe I'm getting it mixed up with someone else. If someone was on Pod Abroad and you guys listen and I am getting this story wrong, please write in and tell us and I'll be happy to correct it in the next episode. So there was an area of the gardens, like far from, like maybe catty corner from the house. Yeah, that house from the castle. And it was an area full, at least at one time, full of copper beeches. Either they were there when we were there, or they used to be there and didn't survive some kind of like storm or something. It was that they were planted for Queen Victoria's visit. But there was something specific that Susan, our guide, mentioned when we were at Drummond Castle Gardens. And of course, Drummond Castle is germane to DOA because it, well, not DOA, excuse me, to Outlander, because of course, that is where season two, The Garden of Versailles, was filmed. So yeah, so Copper Beaches, I remember hearing at during Pod Abroad. So it's kind of weird. It makes sense that it's a popular, not unheard of thing, even in those days, that tree was around. So I did look it up to see if there's anything that would be more descriptive about it. And the European beech is a very popular ornamental tree in parks and large gardens in temperate regions of the world. In North America, they are preferred for this purpose over the native F. grandifolia, which is the Latin name, which despite its tolerance of warmer climates, is slower growing, taking an average of 10 years longer to attain maturity. And this tree is frequently kept clipped to make attractive hedges. And since the early 19th century, there have been numerous cultivators of European beech made by horticultural selection. And something else that Roger remembers is Mount Gerald. It is said to have been built following the old custom of having the foundation laid over a body as a human sacrifice. Now, I looked up Mount Gerald. It is actually a place in Scotland. I wasn't able to find any confirmation that it was actually a building of a type in Inverness, at least in real life. And this is what I found on Wikipedia about Mount Gerald, a Scottish Gaelic, which I will butcher, I hope not too badly, is An Clown. It's a small hamlet which lies close to the head of the Cromarty Firth on the west coast, 2 miles northeast of Dingwall, in the western edge of Rosshire, Scottish Highlands, and is in the Scottish Council area of Highland. Now, this is more about that human sacrifice that Diana writes. Supposedly, quote, a workman had been lured into the hold of the cellar and a great stone dropped onto him from the top of the newly built wall, crushing him to death. He had been buried there, his blood a propitiation to the hungry spirits of the earth, who, thus satisfied, had allowed the edifice to stand prosperous and untroubled through the years, unquote. On the topic of sacrifice and foundations, I am not knowledgeable. Do you know anything about it, Sam?
I don't, but I'm super curious. I'm curious because I want to know, I would like to be present at the first time somebody got the idea that that was a good idea. Like what the thought process was. Like, did it happen accidentally once and the house
That's what I'm
stood
wondering.
For a really long time and they're like, we must do this all the time? Or was it just somebody who was like, I really hate Dave. I'm going to bury Dave in this building.
Blue Apron is teaming up with best-selling cookbook author Chrissy Teigen to bring you some of her favorite recipes to make at home. Get ready for 6 weeks of wildly fun, flavorful cooking featuring recipes like garlic and soy glazed shrimp with charred broccoli and hot green pepper sauce and sesame chicken noodles with bok choy. Did we mention you don't have to step foot in the grocery store?
Blue Apron delivers fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes right to your door that can be cooked in under 45 minutes. The menu changes every week based on what's in season and is designed by Blue Apron's in-house culinary team or Chrissy Teigen. I'm so excited. I book my boxes out like weeks in advance. So I've been monitoring all of the Chrissy Teigen menus that keep popping up, and she has a Chinese chicken salad or an Asian chicken salad that's coming up in a few weeks that I'm really excited about.
My box arrived late Tuesday night, and I'm so excited to try the pipe rigatti and roasted red pepper sauce with Parmesan broccoli.
I love broccoli.
Yes, so I'm very excited about that. So check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free at blueapron.com/outlander. That's blueapron.com/outlander to get your first 3 meals free.
Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Okay, so I looked for a few sources. There's a lot out there, and I'm sure if I took longer or took more time or had more time, I could find something that was specific to Celtic practices, ancient Celtic practices. I found something that was available through opensiuc.lib.siu.edu. So it's a university, and I'm not sure the date of the document, but it's in type, so it's not, you know, very, very old. I don't think it's more than 100 or so years old, but I don't know. We'll include this in the show notes now. So there's a number of pictures, so it's not full pages, but I'm going to read it. And hopefully you'll find this as interesting as I did. Okay, it's called Foundations Laid in Human Sacrifice. Perhaps the most persistent among religious superstitions from the beginning of mankind down into so-called civilized ages has been the custom of offering human sacrifices and burying them in the foundation stones of important buildings, especially in the fortifications of cities. It is difficult to explain the underlying idea with certainty, since in all cases of superstitious practices, which date back to a remote antiquity, we have no historical information as to the original theory of the custom. We only know that it continued and that in later days, different ideas prevailed. It is probable that the victim was a sacrifice offered to the deity, but we have also reason to assume that it was intended to serve as a guardian spirit who would protect the city from all harm. In all these barbarous customs, we must consider that the idea of killing a man, an infant, a woman, was not so terrible to the savage, for to him, man's soul is immortal. Okay, this is Ginger. Side note. Similar to language used in DOA, which obviously is the 20th century. The Outlander series spans the 20th century, but even though it was written by a contemporary author, it is written using language, or not description of like someone would describe something in the 18th century, but using language, at least the language of letters, the language of any books she mentions, and the language, the speech of the characters reflects their time in their history. Similarly, the document I'm reading, as I said, it's not new. So language such as words such as savage, etc., mean more along the lines of heathen, don't mean Native American or indigenous or Indian, as some would say, at least not that I found. So just an aside, I'm reading it verbatim. And by the time we share this, I hope to have the actual full source name where this was excerpted from. He had not the slightest doubt that every being that died or was slain survived and could at will put on another transfigured body, closely resembling his own. We might call it the dream body, which was the figure in which he appeared to the survivors in dreams. This was supposed to move about as freely as we ourselves and visit places at the most remote distances with unheard-of swiftness, and was not bound by the usual laws of gravity or the rules of time and space. A person, whether infant or adult, that was sacrificed for some religious purpose was not supposed to be slain. He continued to live, and lived in a kind of superior life, the life of a demigod. He was transfigured into a spiritual presence that received divine honors, and so his condition was really envied. We may as well assume that originally the honor of being sacrificed was courted by many people, and the ghastly idea of the honor of such a death was absolutely present. But with the change of man's religious notions, the practice became more and more horrible and outrageous. People continued it because they considered it necessary. Their ancestors had done it to give stability to a building, and so the ceremony had to be done, whatever might be the cost. And the further man grew away from his primitive, barbarous ideas, the more the victim shrank from it, until finally he was forced to this unnatural death against his will. Traces of burial alive have been found among all the nations of the earth, without any exception, which indicates that the custom is as old as the art of architecture, and so under the most ancient buildings, which date back to pre-Christian ages, we find some human skeleton embedded under the foundation stones. It seems that in the progress of civilization, these horrible sacrifices were more and more discouraged because people may have felt instinctively that the custom was not right. And so the sacrifices which had been performed in ancient times were deemed to be sufficient even when fortifications were to be rebuilt. An exception was made, however, in case the city had been cursed in the name of the national deity. It was regarded as blasphemy to live in such a cursed city, for the man who dared to stay there disregarded the curse of his god. For instance, one of Job's friends, Eliphaz, counts it as one indication of a very reprobate man that he would live in such desolate cities. The curse pronounced on a conquered town, which should remain destroyed forever, is recorded in Deuteronomy chapter 13, verse 16, where we read, quote, "It shall be an heap forever. It shall not be built again," unquote. When Jericho was destroyed at the special command of God, all its inhabitants were slain, quote, "both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and ass," unquote, with the sole exception of Rahab, who had betrayed the city into the hands of the enemies of her countrymen. And Joshua adjured the people, saying, "Cursed be the man for the Lord that riseth up and buildeth this city Jericho. He shall lay the foundation thereof in his firstborn, and in his youngest son shall he set up the gates of it," unquote. Jericho, however, was sure to be rebuilt sooner or later, for being the key to Palestine and commanding the entrance into the country from the desert routes, it was too important both for commercial and strategic purposes to be left in ruins. And the man who undertook the work was still superstitious and savage enough to heed Joshua's curse. We read in the first book of Kings with reference to the reign of Ahab, chapter 16, verse 34. Quote, "In his days, Heel the Bethelite built Jericho. He laid the foundation stones thereof in Abiram, his firstborn, and set up the gates thereof in his youngest son, Segub, according to the word of the Lord, which he spake by Joshua, the son of Nun," unquote. It appears that the curse of Joshua on the city of Jericho had reference only to the fortifications of Jericho and not to the town itself, which is an oasis and an important station for caravans. The rebuilding of the city took place under Ahab, who governed from 876 to 853 CE, Common Era. And this source has BC, but of course I will use what academia uses, which is CE, Common Era. Sorry, BCE, but before the Common Era. Some archaeologists believe that the idea of burying alive is due to the notion that the forces of nature, be they gods, demons, or giants, and later in their stead, the devil, were supposed to possess the privilege of collecting rent from mankind. The spirit of the soil was supposed to be the landlord to whom payment was to be made by an offering of human life. Grimm says, quote, "Frequently it was regarded as necessary to entomb within the foundation of a building living creatures and even men, an act which was regarded as a sacrifice to the soil, which had to endure the weight of the structure. By this cruel custom, people hoped to attain permanence and stability for great buildings," unquote. There are innumerable stories which preserve records of this barbaric custom, and there can be no doubt that many of them are historical and that the practice continued until comparatively recent time. We read in Thiele that the walls of Copenhagen always sank down again and again, although they were constantly rebuilt, until the people took an innocent little girl, placed her on a chair before a table, gave her toys and sweets, and while she merrily played, 12 masons covered the vault and finished the wall, which since that time remained stable. Scutari is said to have been built in a similar way. A ghost appeared while the fortress was in the process of building and demanded that the wife of one of the three kings, who should bring the food to the masons on the next day, should be entombed in the foundation. Being a young mother, she was permitted to nurse her baby, and a hole was left for that purpose, which was closed as soon as the child was weaned. We read in F.
Wait
Norks,
a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute.
How... How close to weaning was this? How long was she feeding a baby through a hole in a wall? And were they feeding her?
They had to have.
I'm against this.
Well, she couldn't produce milk.
You know what they really needed back then was a really good architect. Because I feel like if they had people who knew how to read the conditions and build in the right places, they wouldn't have needed to sacrifice so many people or have babies eat through holes.
Well, the baby was in with her and she handed it out when it was done. We read in F. Norks, Sitten und Gebräuche, that when in 1813 the ice broke the dam of the river Elbe and the engineers had great trouble in repairing it, an old man addressed the dike inspector, saying, "You will never repair the dike unless you bury in it an innocent child, innocent little child." And Grimm adduced even a more modern instance, which dates from around the year 1843. Quote, "When the new bridge in Halle was built," Grimm tells us, "the people talked of a child which should be buried in its foundations." So long did these superstitions continue after the cruel rite had been abandoned, and they were held not only in spite of higher morality, which Christianity taught, but even in the name of Christianity. In Tomaseo's Canti Popolari, an instance is quoted of the voice of an archangel from heaven bidding the builders of a wall and tomb, the wife of the architect and its foundation. The practice is here regarded as Christian, and it is apparent that there are instances in which Christian authorities were sufficiently ignorant to sanction it, for even the erection of churches was supposed to require the same cruel sacrifice. And there were cases in which, according to the special sanctity of the place, it was deemed necessary to bury a priest, because children and women were not regarded as sufficient. In Günther's Sagenbuch des Deutschen Volkes, we read that the Strasbourg Cathedral required the sacrifice of two human lives, and that two brothers lie buried in its foundations. The excavations in Palestine have brought to light such sacrifices in the foundation stones of ancient walls, and we here reproduce a drawing after Shoemaker in his description of the Tel el-Mutasalim. It is the site of the biblical Megiddo, or Megiddo, where the fatal battle with King Necho was fought in 609 BCE, in which King Josiah fell. In the foundations of a wall lying 2.3 meters underground was found above the lowest layer of stones a jar 1.9 meters long and 0.4 in diameter, which was partly crushed by the second layer of stones. It contained the skeleton of a child and three clay vessels, presumably offerings made to the spirit of the victim, as it was customary even in the Middle Ages, whenever persons were buried alive, to give them rations of water and bread, which were placed in their tomb. Wait, why? Why would you give people food and water if they're going to be buried alive? Just prolong the stuff?
Maybe. Maybe they want to, until the air runs out, they'll let them keep eating. I have to tell you guys about an amazing new service I found called Framebridge. They make it easy and affordable to custom frame your favorite things, from art prints and posters to photos on your phone. Here's how it works. Just go to framebridge.com and upload your favorite photos from your computer or directly from your Instagram feed for them to print. Or if you have a physical item like ticket stubs, art prints, posters, you name it, they'll provide you secure prepaid packaging so you can mail it in for free.
Preview your item online in any frame style. Choose your favorite or get free recommendations from their talented designers. The expert team at Framebridge will custom frame your item in days, not weeks or months, and deliver your finished piece directly to your door, ready to hang.
The best part? Instead of the hundreds you'd pay at a framing store, their prices start at $39 and all shipping is free.
Plus, our listeners will get 15% off their first order at framebridge.com when they use our code Outlander.
Framebridge has thousands of five-star reviews and even offers a happiness guarantee. If for any reason you aren't 100% satisfied with your order, they'll make it right.
So something we're so excited to have used Framebridge for is for an upcoming holiday that we enjoy. We, at least I'm a daddy's girl, we both love our dad like endless amounts, blah, blah, blah. And so we decided to use Framebridge to get a photo printed that was one of Summer and I that we took in Scotland on this year's Pod Abroad.
We did. And it was so easy to use. I just went onto the website. I dragged and dropped and put it in there. And I used the free recommendations from their designers. And what they did is they sent me four options to choose from. They gave you the price based on the size, and they picked the size that is best fitting for the resolution of your photo, which is great because you don't have to wonder if they're going to send it to you and it's going to be all bloated or pixelated or weird looking.
So get started framing your photos or art today. Go to framebridge.com and use promo code Outlander. You'll save an additional 15% off your first order.
Just go to framebridge.com, promo code Outlander. That's framebridge.com, promo code Outlander.
The top of the wall was covered by a carefully made layer containing a canal to draw off the water lest the foundation stones be washed away. In the same place at Megiddo, a whole cemetery of infants has been discovered, and it is not impossible that we have here the horrible instance of the offering of the firstborn, which is alluded to in Exodus 22, verse 29. Quote, thou shalt not delay to offer the first of thy ripe fruits and of thy liquors. The firstborn of thy sons shalt thou give me. Unquote. The request of the firstborn as belonging to God is presupposed in Exodus 11:4, where Yahweh takes the firstborn of the Egyptians, and also in the story of Abraham's sacrifice, where the offering of Isaac, his firstborn, is not completed, but a ram is substituted. In the progress of civilization, the horrible practice of human sacrifices was more and more abandoned, and substitutes were made, first with animals and later with symbols. The excavators of the city of Gezer in Palestine have found human figures made of silver, which are obviously a substitute for real human beings. They were embedded in the foundation stones in the same place where in more ancient times human skeletons were buried under the walls, in cornerstones, and under the gates. Not infrequently, we find dishes and lamps, which are placed in a curious way inside one another or side by side. We reproduce here one of the lamps encased in a dish. They have some drawings here, too. Mr. Charles Halleck, in his interesting book, Peerless Alaska, speaks of the sacrifices which have been made, even in our days, among the Indians in these, our northern possessions. He says, quote, "Slaves are often killed at housewarmings, one being placed under each of the corner uprights when the frame was raised, the ceremony being sometimes attended with the greatest cruelty. With the house of irregular foundation lines, the sacrifice of life was great." Unquote. Even in Europe, the custom of burying victims in the foundation of important buildings continued long after Christianity had been introduced. Not a few of the most important buildings, especially castles and fortifications, frequently proved to have remnants of unhappy victims under their cornerstones. For instance, the tradition is pretty well established that the foundations of the Kremlin, the imperial dwelling at Moscow, were laid in human sacrifices. Our frontispiece represents the barbarous act of starting the building of this great castle, and we see how the laborers have taken hold of a beautiful woman who was dragged to her tomb against her will. In the background stands the priest who is to bless the victim and to give her the comfort of the sacraments. Gustav Freytag, in his novel The Lost Manuscript, mentions the old custom of burying offerings in the foundation stones of new structures. The hero of the novel, Professor Vanna, searches for a lost copy of Tacitus and hopes to find it in the foundation walls, where they were marked by a slab of peculiar form and color. On the removal of the slab, he discovers the bones of a dog, which goes far to prove that the building was very old, for it was evidence that the man who built it still deemed it necessary to have a living being entombed there as a substitute for the ancient human sacrifice of primitive times. We will share this link to this interesting little tidbits there about human sacrifice. You're welcome. Oh my goodness. So that's what Roger was talking about, or what Diana was writing about. Did you learn anything, Summer?
I learned a lot of things that I wish that I didn't learn.
So should we like name this episode Who'd You Bury?
Feeding a baby through a hole.
Oh Lord. Is that Siri?
My thumb hit my phone in a weird way.
Christine O writes, "It's wonderful to be on this journey with Roger the historian. We get the ultimate historical tour of Inverness through his eyes. All of us who walk down streets today and wish we could see them through a 200-year-old lens are delighted right along with him. He wonders whether the local story about the notorious origins of the big house, Mount Gerald, are true." The house is only about 20 years old in 1769, so maybe he'll find out. Lorraine B. writes, "A church, a pub, and to him the old Mount Gerald house are exactly where he expected them, albeit looking much newer. The glaring lack of the manse and many churches along the banks drives home that he's not in Kansas anymore." So could you imagine if we did that today, the whole like burying a something something? No, I just can't.
I mean, not for those purposes and not under those circumstances. So, I mean, it would be like if the family fish dies, I'm going to either, well, the first time we buried it, the second time we flushed it, because I was like, I'm not digging for another fish. But like, you know, family pets, those get buried in the yard.
Oh, yeah.
But not for the purpose
but
of.
But not under a fund. You don't kill them for the
foundation. No. They all died of natural causes ish.
That's what she tells us.
That's what everyone tells everyone.
That's true. So Roger has other things to do, though. He's enjoying this little walk down memory lane-ish, but he's got plans. He turns toward the docks. Just imagine what he was thinking. Quote, with the feeling of what could only be called deja vu, he pushed open the door of a pub. Half-timbered entry with his stone flags was as he had seen it a week before, about 200 years hence, and the familiar smell of hops and yeast in the air was a comfort to his spirit. The name had changed, but not the smell of beer. Unquote. I couldn't even imagine, first of all, in America, well, on the West Coast, there's not much, I mean, maybe a mission, an old mission maybe, but there's not much, like, no European built or Western, quote unquote, Western built buildings that are that old. So definitely on the East Coast of the U.S., you have a better chance of that. But could you imagine?
It's like, for instance, growing up, there was in town this place called Merlino's. And they made they called them freezes. And it was like a scooped, like not a beverage, but not an ice cream, but it was like a scooped frozen treat that you would eat with a spoon and then it would melt while you ate it and you could drink the rest or whatever. But they had this one location for years and years and years and years and years. And at some point, this location was bought by another place who does exactly the same thing and sells the freezes, but now they're not called Merlino's freezes. Now they're Hagen's freezes. So it's like tricky because you go in there and everything looks the same and everything smells the same and even the food's the same, but it's not the same.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine, I mean, doing what he's doing, which I know we'll never do.
Never say never. We just haven't found the right stones yet.
That's why we're going back on Potterbra 2019. Right.
We'll add in some new stones this
time. If you want to join our interest list, send us an email at hello@allenderpod.com.
Hello.
Oh, Lord. Okay. I'm not going to stop. And apparently neither is she. Okay. So Roger got some beer and he took a drink and almost choked. The barman gave him a bucket of sand. Now, when I first saw this, I was like, wait, what? Obviously a bucket. I get the bucket. Was it just because when I finished the paragraph or finished that passage and Roger left or he walked away when it was clear that Roger was not going to vomit. If he had had a bucket, he would have just given him the empty bucket. You know, he was sanding the floors. He was already doing a task when he walked by Robert. Oh my gosh. By Roger. And then he saw that he was like looking kind of sickly. So first of all, my first thought was, wait, did people vomit into buckets with sand on purpose? And then I'm like, well, no, he just had the bucket already because he was sanding the floors. And then I thought, what the hell is this sanding the floors thing?
Now, where was he sanding the floors?
The barman was walking around sprinkling sand on the floors.
Probably to keep it like from slip hazards.
Yeah, that's my best guess. And then anything I looked, I couldn't find anything historically about sanding wooden floors of bars or any kind of like establishment. But of course, because it's the word sand, everything that kept coming up was like how to sand your wood floors. I'm like, yeah, that's not really what I meant, but it's where it came from. It started with sand. So the beer that he was drinking right at that moment, I call it the then beer. The then beer had a higher alcohol content than his previous new beer, meaning from his own time. Roger, we learn, he was there in that pub to watch and to listen. There were sea captains and merchants, sailors, longshoremen, and laborers. Lots of business was being transacted there. And he's just listening, and he hears all sorts of deals being made for things to be shipped to the colonies. And this included people. One specific clerk was interviewing people. Listening, Roger learned that the ship was bound for Virginia. The cost of passage for a gentleman was £10, 8 shillings. There were lower costs if you stayed in steerage, and for those who had no money, there was, of course, indenture. Now, if you remember, we talked at length last week about indentured servitude and how it had some similarities or some commonalities with slavery. Obviously, with the major difference is while some people may have been sold into indentured servitude against their will, they may not have given permission. In most cases, their indenture had like a sell-by date. So they would be actually able to be free once, and whereas slaves did not have that chance. So Roger sees the clerk say to a man that him, his wife, and two elder sons could be taken. But the young girls, their young girls, would have to be sold. Holy monkey. That's like a Sophie's Choice, right? I mean, it's not quite as well, almost. So Sophie's Choice, it's like legit ones going off to a camp, maybe. But this one, I mean, I don't even know. There's nowhere I can go with that to make that statement better. But the father only wants assurance that the two girls, who will have to be sold, will be able to go together.
No one's going to make that guarantee. If he did, he's not going to follow through on that.
Oh, he's not going to, he won't be held to it, but he can say whatever he wants if it gets him what he wants.
That's like when you surrender your pets at the shelter and you're like, they're going to stay together, right? You're going to keep them together. Don't give them to a home and separate them. And they're going to be like, dude, we want to get rid of these animals. If we can get them to home separately, they're going to home separately.
Well, it depends. I've worked or volunteered at an SPCA where an owner of two cats had died. And she obviously shouldn't have a person to take them, but she had enough, I mean, I'm guessing, enough money for their care and request that they be adopted together. And they, I hate to say on display, but there was like a, not really a cage, but basically a clear plexiglass cage in the rock walkway when you first entered. And it was these two beautiful cats just there for everyone to see. And they had lost their owner, and I'm sure they were eventually adopted. But this was also Monterey, so a lot of people had a lot of money. So I'm not worried about those pets, about those cats. So Roger he sees this and he's like, yeah, I got to go. Ruminating on the scene he just witnessed. And he's very thankful that he, at this moment, was strong and could work. The history he studied and grown up hearing about had come to life before his very eyes. Quote, he knew all about the sale of lands that forced small crofters off their lands their families had tended for hundreds of years, all about the dreadful conditions of penury and starvation in the cities, the simple insupportableness of life in Scotland in these days, and not all his years of reading and study had prepared him for the look of that woman's face. Her eyes fixed on the fresh, sanded floor, her daughter's hands clutched hard in her own. Unquote. Roger had exactly 14 shillings, 3 pence, and a couple of copper doits and farthings. He's like, it's not definitely not enough.
That's not enough.
He has a think. He could cross to France and take a ship from there, or go to Edinburgh. But it would be later in the year, and that might affect his being able to leave in a timely manner, and Bree was already 6 weeks ahead of him. He didn't have time, either, to save up for passage. First, he wants to make sure, for sure, that he knows where she's gone. The harbor master's office was in the same location as it was in his own time. He gets the attention of one of the clerks and asks for the register of the last few months. And he also asks the clerk how much he makes. He's like, look, I may as well ask. As he's looking through the registry, he gets a historian's.
What are the odds of that? What are the odds of that? That the dude's like, yeah, here, look at my books.
Well, he knew that she left, likely from Inverness.
He knew that she left. But somebody comes into my work that I've never seen before and says, hey, let me look at your files. I don't know you. You can't look at my files.
I think they're like public documents.
Are they?
I'm guessing. It's a shipping registry, so.
Well, they are now because the public saw them.
And Diana wrote about them. So as he's looking through the registry, he gets a historian's thrill, seeing that the sheets that he always saw, yellow and fragile, were crisp and white. He goes over the registries over and over and over and over, and he cannot find her. But he is sure she went through. Right? In the registry under the ship, the Philip Alonso, a Spanish ship, he finally founds her, listed as what appears to be Mr. Brian Fraser. Not really, but close. He can tell that it was definitely, he could make out a Mrs., which was the same abbreviation for mistress, which was for a married woman and a woman who was not, say, a young child. So it was Mrs. Brianna or Brianna Fraser. She had sailed from Inverness on July 4th, 1769, to Fort Charleston, South Carolina. He's confused. Why would she choose South Carolina? Was that as close as she could get to her destination? He gives the book back to the clerk and asks if there's a ship leaving soon for the colonies. Yep, it's called the Gloriana, sailing 2 days from now.
Dun, dun, dun.
Sailing 2 days from now. Roger says he's a seaman and is going to sign on.
I can't. I know, right?
Oh, Summer, you stop it.
That word. I know it means other things, but every...
Harbor Master's office clerk says, quote, her master, the Gloriana, her master works from the friars when he's in port. Likely he'll be there now. Captain Bonnet, unquote. Roger goes off and he finds Bonnet and gives him his name, Mackenzie. Two can play at this game, Brianna. When asked if he had any experience sailing, he says that he's fished in the Minch. And that was... But that was not a sailor. A true
sailor. That sounds like a euphemism.
Oh, Bonnet. Sorry.
He fished in the Minch.
Bonnet has an Irish lilt. Quote, for no reason he could name, Captain Bonnet raised the hairs on the back of his neck. Unquote.
I can name a few.
Bonnet has green eyes. He wants to know why Roger wants to go to sea. Roger is trying to figure out what made him stand out to Bonnet. And he had said something like, your sort. So what about him? He had been watching his language. He watched the way he dressed. He watched his mannerisms. He was trying really hard not to give away his education. And he's still getting the heebie-jeebies from the captain. And ultimately, he tells him, that's really none of your business why I'm doing this. Bonnet lets that go. And he says, you'll be aboard by sundown. 5 shillings a month, meat 3 days a week. Plum duff on Sundays. You'll have a hammock, but find your own clothes. You will be free to leave the ship once the cargo is unloaded. Not until that time. We agreed, sir, and Roger agrees. And turns to leave. Quote, there was a small cold spot at the base of his skull. If he looked back, he knew he would see that lucent green gaze fixed unwaveringly over the edge of the unread book, taking note of every weakness. The cold spot, he thought, was where the teeth would meet. Unquote. Okay, so am I the only one when reading this thought, oh, so now Captain Bonnet is a vampire?
No, I didn't think that.
But you know what I'm referring to.
No.
Okay. If you're an All Souls fan, All Souls Trilogy is a trilogy written by author Deborah Harkness. It has vampires, witches, demons, and of course humans. They're all creatures. Well, non-humans are called creatures. And one of the things in Deb's universe is that if a vampire looks at you, or at least looks at a witch, we don't know about humans, probably not humans. If a vampire looks at you and you're a witch and say your back is to them, their glare feels like cold spots, like little ice, ice snowflakes. That's how it's described. So when I, of course, that never hit me before because last times I had read the book, I wasn't familiar with Deb's stories. So now I read it as like, okay, does that make Bonnet a vampire? And does that mean Roger's a witch?
That's a whole new level.
Mixing your fandoms.
Of things.
Lord have mercy. Christine O writes, we begin to see new aspects of Roger's character evolve beyond how we experienced him in the 1960s. Sure, we knew he was educated, sensitive and kind, persistent, and a bit of a risk taker. But signing up to work in the cargo hold of a wooden ship he's never seen in exchange for a hammock and questionable meat 3 days a week.
So wait, does that mean
he has a lot of cojones?
Meat?
Yes.
Or it's just questionable.
I don't get it.
Well, is it like you're served something and you're like, this is meat? And it might not be meat? Or
I think
just
it's like
old
meat.
Meat.
I think so. Like, I think she means because they have to bring, they have to put all the food in the ship that lasts for 6 weeks or 3 months or whatever, however long the voyage is. Yes, he's in love, Roger, but I still think he shows remarkable courage, especially after his first meeting with the creepy captain, Stephen Bonnet. And now we have a new seaman for Ginger to talk about.
Oh, God.
I know, right? I was like, thanks, Christine.
Stop.
Here's the thing. This is not a spoiler. We will see, obviously, he's going to get on the ship. Well, you don't know that yet, but he gets on the ship. We're going to hear about Bonnet a few times. Bonnet's not going anywhere too far too soon, but whenever he's referred to, it's Bonnet or Captain Bonnet. So it's the good news, dear listener and dear Summer, is that Bonnet is not referred to as a seaman.
Good God, he's a captain. Also, he always makes me think of the Dread Pirate Roberts.
Yeah. Lorraine B. closes us out. And if we had any misapprehensions about how stone cold Stephen Bonnet is, Roger gets a case of the willies just sitting across from the man while he tries to book passage with him. The hairs on the back of Roger's neck rise. He likens Bonnet's gaze to a leopard watching a passing wildebeest, trying to decide whether to give chase or not. He gets dry mouthed and feels a cold grew at the base of his skull, knowing Bonnet is taking note of his every weakness. All in all, I found this a very satisfying chapter of Roger's first experience in the past. When Roger has little trouble finding proof of Brianna's passage to Charleston, South Carolina, it makes me wonder, just what did Frank know?
I don't think that has anything to do with Frank.
That's not the point. Her point is, if I understand correctly, if Roger could find that so easily, Frank could. And if Frank could find it, that goes into a lot, which we can't talk about, which I love, but we can't talk about.
And that was chapter 36. Join us next week when we'll be discussing chapter 37 entitled Gloriana.
As always, join us to continue the conversation in our Facebook community. Find us at outlanderpod.com/group.
And there are still slots if you want to contribute to our read-along. You can find out more about that if you go to www.outlanderpod.com/DOA.
And if you love our show and are entertained by it, please consider supporting us. Please consider... please don't ever support me. I don't know what that means. Please consider supporting us on Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/outlanderpod. And as I mentioned, kind of, it was not in my notes. If you have heard about Pod Abroad 2018 and you've heard about this thing called an interest list, what's this? For our 2019 trip, there's still time to join the interest list. We hope to have information available by the end of June. And what we're going to do is share the information with the interest list first. Now, we're not adding more spots. There'll be about 26 spots only. And the interest list is now around 115. I know that not every single person on there is going to reach out and try to get it. I don't expect that. We don't expect that. But if even like, you know, a tenth of people, you know, kind of go at it, it could be snapped up really quickly. So the reason I say that is because I don't know. We don't know if there will be anything to offer publicly except to say, it's done. So if you would like to be the among the first to hear about Pod Abroad 2019, again, it's just information, but we will share the itinerary, the pricing, the schedule, and possible outlines of maybe some. So everything will be set for the days, like the cities, the order of things. What won't be set are kind of the nightly things, like maybe some whiskey tastings or whatever, but they're all optional. So you're going to get the information, and that will go to our interest list first. So we do encourage you to join because, again, no obligation, it's just information. But if you want to be among the first to get to it and not take a chance that there might be a space after we offer it, before we go public, that's definitely your call. But if you would like to be in the interest list, send us an email to hello@outlanderpod.com and we will add you. So thank you guys so much for joining us again. We're still so happy to be back. And don't forget, if you're coming to San Diego Comic-Con this July, so I guess 2018, we would love to see you. And we really would hope that you would be able to make it to our panel. We don't have dates, times, locations, or anything like that yet. We're waiting for them to release the schedule so we can find out too. But have it in mind if you're heading down south. So thank you guys always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.